most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, yeah. all the way up. Where can you go from there?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff...
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Now, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but maybe extrapolate a little more on your perspective of being in ufology and sort of coming from that other side, you know, how the government's always sort of seen as the enemy and for many people in ufology. You say that there's not a cover-up, and I believe that you believe that, but talk about how it may be frustrating to deal with the people that are always trying to get you to slip up or are disappointed that you're not going to blow the whistle on some big thing or all those strange feelings you must get from all the various people in the world of ufology who want a different sort of situation to come out of this.
Sure. I mean, I'm not saying that somewhere, probably not in Britain, but somewhere, there isn't a crashed UFO in a hangar somewhere and alien bodies. But what I'm saying is, if there are such things, I have never seen them myself, and I have never been briefed on them, and I have never picked up the slightest hint from my official work that such things exist. So all I can do is call it how I see it and say, look, I haven't seen these things. Now, a lot of people who believe that there are such things think, well, either I must be lying, or I must be a disinformation agent, or I must have been out of the loop, or any other number of different theories. Mm-hmm. So it is frustrating. I find myself accused of all sorts of things by the UFO community. But all I can do is be as honest and truthful as I can and say, look, I'm not debunking the UFO phenomenon. Far from it. I think there are serious defense, national security, and flight safety issues here. I would be horrified if the British government closed down the UFO project, though I think they probably will. I'm a passionate believer that the subject should be taken seriously, but I haven't seen any crashed saucers and dead aliens. And that upsets diehard conspiracy theorists. But in a sense, you see, nothing I can say to people like that is going to convince them.
Yeah.
So in a sense, there's no point my even engaging with people who so strongly have those beliefs, because my denial will simply be seen as lies and disinformation. So I'm in a lose-lose situation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the big problems, I think, with ufology, in that here you are, a highly credible former government employee of the British government, you know, and you're pro-UFO, you're pro-serious UFO investigation, but because you're not saying exactly what a lot of people in ufology want to hear, they're not embracing that with the gusto that they should, and that's disappointing.
It is disappointing, and the worst thing is that actually I think the demonization of government and military by the UFO community is just about the most destructive thing in the entire phenomenon, because if people would simply sort of acknowledge that, look, governments are in a difficult position here. There are sightings, undeniably, all around the world that governments and the military can't explain. What actually should be happening is that there should be serious discussion between governments, the military, the scientific community, the intelligence community, the public, the elected representatives, and people should be saying, look, let's work on this in a collaborative way. But when a small handful of conspiracy theorists absolutely demonize government and the military and accuse anyone who has been involved in this subject from an official side of being part of a cover-up, it's no wonder that governments and the military sort of take a step back and say, well, I'm not, why should we talk to these people?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's something that needs to change, I think.
I mean, another classic example is the dogfight between the ufology and scientists, radio astronomers doing SETI. Mm-hmm. To me, it seems that these are two different groups of people who, broadly speaking, are interested in the same thing, but approaching it with a different methodology. Well, shouldn't these two groups of people sit down and talk to each other and say, well, you know, that's not the way we do things, but hey, we're after the same thing, so let's talk. But what actually happens is UFO people kind of accuse the SETI community of being part of the cover-up, and the SETI community accuses the UFO lobby of being bunch of nutcases. You know, this is hardly conducive to the proper taking forward of a very serious issue.
Exactly, yes, definitely. Just to give people an idea sort of like what an average day in the life of the UFO project is, take me through sort of what would be like an average case that you would get and how you'd sort of go through looking at it.
Okay. Well, the average day would be getting in and then finding, because of course proportionally quite a lot of the sightings are actually at night. So what I would do is that I would come into the office somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, and I would receive reports of any UFO sightings that had been phoned in during the preceding night by the duty officers. And then essentially I would begin an investigation, and it would go something like this. The first thing that I would do is almost just apply common sense. I would take a look at the information and say, well, what does this sound like it might be? Because statistically, historically, we knew both from Blue Book and from our own files that you know, most UFOs would turn out to be misidentifications. So what I would do was apply a bit of common sense and say, well, okay, if you're dealing with a bright white light and a red and green light either side, that's probably an aircraft. I mean, it's in a sense, it's as simple as that. But what I would then try and do is basically a detective job. I would have, for example, all sorts of information available to me. I would have information on flight paths. I would have information on where military exercises were taking place. I would have all the information about weather balloon launches, satellite paths. I would have astronomical data. I would have information about airships, all this sort of thing. And what I would then do is try and correlate the UFO sighting with all of this information that I had. Another big part of any UFO investigation, of course, is radar. And I would engage with the Air Force specialists and say, right, we've had a UFO sighting in this location at this time. Let's have a look at the radar tapes and see if there's anything unusual there. Let's liaise with the local police. Let's see if we can find out whether they were alerted to anything unusual, or indeed whether they had reports of other sightings. And as we touched on earlier in the interview, I would speak to the UFO community themselves and say, look, we've got an interesting sighting here. Have you got anything? So that was the sort of bread and butter of the job, the day-to-day business of doing it. So in a sense, although we talk about the real X-Files, there was no running around in warehouses with torches and guns. It was rather more scientific and methodological in its approach.
So you never had to kill anybody?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, that's disappointing. Now, I saw that you estimated 80% can be explained. 80% of the cases that you got can be explained. 15% insufficient evidence, insufficient information. And then there's the 5% of cases that cannot be explained. For those 5%, what became of those? Did they get put into a special file, or they sort of just, you know, mixed in with all the rest?
This is a complete catch-22. Yeah, they weren't separated out, so they're all in the same files. The UFO files tend to be organized just by date, so you will get, sometimes you'll get a file which will just be all the UFO sightings that occurred in one particular year. And that's the most common way it's been done. So they're not split out into identifieds, unidentifieds, or insufficient data. They're all just there in date order. And, you know, you'll go through them and you'll find some probably just aircraft lights and some very interesting. But as to what you do with them, this was, of course, the ultimate frustration. Once you'd eliminated all the conventional possibilities, all you could actually say is, look, we're fairly sure that this isn't a misidentification of aircraft lights, weather balloons, satellites, meteors, etc. We know what it isn't, but we don't know what it is. So when I talked earlier about my skeptical head of division briefing the assistant chief of the air staff and saying there is some evidence to suggest that an unidentified object or objects was operating over the UK, the answer came back, well, this is very interesting, but you've actually, of course, done all the investigation that you could do. Where else can you take this? And that's the ultimate frustration of UFO investigations.
Of the 5%, I guess you could say. Like in your head or in your notes or something anywhere, do you have, like, which cases, you know, people should be sure to check out in the long run?
Oh, I think it will all come out under the Freedom of Information Act. The sorts of things that make a UFO case very interesting, the sorts of things that put it into that 5%, are fairly sort of common sense things. It's, for example, where the witness is somebody like a pilot or a police officer or, you know, military personnel. It might be where there's a photograph or a video that's been subjected to technical analysis by Air Force specialists who look at imagery in the course of their normal duties, and where they've found no evidence of any fakery or anything conventional. It might be the fact that the visual sighting has been correlated on radar, or it might be the case that a combination of all these factors, say pilot sighting and radar data, has shown an object just doing, as I think I mentioned earlier, speeds and maneuvers that we can't match. Mm-hmm. So it's those sorts of things that put a UFO sighting into that 5%.
Yeah. One of the things that I just found out recently when I was doing the research for the interview that was really surprising was that you ended up getting a lot of other weird stuff to investigate at the UFO project, stuff like abductions, animal mutilations, crop circles, ghosts at military bases. Talk a little bit about, you know, some of the other weird peripheral stuff that ended up getting tossed into your lap because you were the UFO guy.
Yes, it happened really by default. This was not in my formal terms of reference, but you simply can't be looking at UFOs without finding that anything else weird and wonderful comes your way, simply because there's nowhere else to send it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when in 1985 a farmer noticed strange patterns in his crops and accused military helicopters, he said, look, the army must be doing some sort of low-flying training and ruining my crops with the downwash from the rotor blades, causing these weird circles in my crops. The military investigated, because of course they want to keep the farming community happy because they do a lot of military training on their land. They said, look, it's not us. It's impossible for a helicopter to cause these sorts of patterns, but we'll send a report to the Ministry of Defense. Well, the only place they could send that report was the UFO project, because that was the only thing they could think. Where else do you send reports of strange phenomena? So, yes, we found ourselves getting all sorts of things. I've spoken to many, many security police personnel who guard military establishments. Very tough people, you know, with guard dogs, guns, all that. Scared to go in particular areas because they say, well, it's haunted. And marvelous ghost stories that you hear from military personnel, some of which have been published in the Ministry of Defense's kind of house magazine. The editor a few years ago ran a letter from a military police officer on patrol who'd seen a ghost and added a little remark at the end, and just said, has anyone else got an interesting story like this. Absolutely, dozens and dozens of stories came from very, very tough, no-nonsense military police officers, but who said, look, we've seen these things, and they're just unreal.
And what would you do when you got a call on something like that? How do you handle that kind of call?
There's really nothing much you can do. I mean, I got some calls, for example, about ghost sightings in the very building in which I worked, the Ministry of Defence's headquarters building on Whitehall, which was built, we knew, on the site of the old Whitehall Palace. So it's a site where habitation goes back hundreds upon hundreds of years. And yes, of course, I would take a look down there, but I've never seen anything myself. These things, it's odd. They seem to be seen by people who have no particular knowledge or interest about them. I think sometimes if you go looking for these things, you won't find them. They'll find you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, there's very little that you can do to investigate a ghost sighting like that.
I noticed that you sort of kind of moved into the abduction realm. You seem to have an interest in abduction. You've done some work with abductions. I heard you talk to about 100 different people with abduction stories. What sort of precipitated your move from UFO investigation into abductions?
Well, I suppose there is a link, because, of course, the abductees say that in a literal sense, they believe that they're taken into a UFO. So I think it's a sort of fair link to make. But again, I didn't go out looking for these people. They found me. Just as people would report UFO sightings to the Ministry of Defence, some people would report abduction experiences. And then after I left the UFO project, many, many people, when I spoke about this issue in public, again contacted me privately. So I've investigated, yes, as you say, over the years, probably about 100 cases here in Britain. And it's extremely interesting. I don't know what's going on. Something's going on. These aren't people after sort of 15 minutes of fame. I do a lot of work with the media, and they always say, can you get some abductees? And the answer is, no, actually, I can't, because they're not interested in television and newspapers for the most part.
And one of the things you've been particularly critical about is the lack of a plan for dealing with an ET discovery. If a UFO were to land on the White House lawn, or if they were to hover over Big Ben, there doesn't seem to be a plan for dealing with an ET discovery. I guess talk a little bit about your take on that lack of a plan, and also feel free to sort of segue that into the media firestorm that came about when you sort of went public with your criticisms late last year, around this time last year, when you resigned from the Ministry of Defense.
Yes, I felt that the scientific community have their detection protocol for what to do if radio astronomers ever detect a signal which they think comes from an extraterrestrial civilization. So the scientific community at least has something, some sort of contingency plan for who to call, what to do, where to go. The government, the military, has nothing. And this, to me, is a mistake. This is a classic low-probability, high-consequence situation, which, even if you're skeptical about UFOs, you should say, well, okay, chances are it won't happen. But if it does, and we don't have a plan, that's not a good situation to be in.
Yeah.
I've worked with the military for 21 years. You have a plan for just about everything, however unlikely. It didn't seem to me too much to ask to have a plan for first contact, not least to address issues such as the potential biological hazard that might arise from contact with an extraterrestrial species. Now, I made these sorts of discussions in a very comments in a fairly low-key way in the first interviews that I gave when I left the Ministry of Defence last year. And the popular press here seized upon them, and some of the headlines in national newspapers saying that I'd been talking about an imminent alien invasion. I mean, the whole situation got completely out of control, I had to go on national television on the BBC to correct my remarks. The whole thing became a phenomenal media circus. It was an interesting time. It really was.
It sounds like it. It sounds like you were probably more frustrated that it came about that way than anything. Although I guess it did raise awareness of the issue in some respects.
Yes, I don't know what to think. In a sense, yes, you're right. It did raise awareness. On the other hand, I think it muddied the waters a little bit, that people were talking about scare stories about alien invasion rather than some of the more serious defense and national security issues that I would have liked to have seen discussed. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, one of the very obvious things that comes up time and time again is the flight safety implications of the UFO phenomenon. There have been a number of near misses between commercial airliners and UFOs over the years. One case from Britain in 1995, a commercial airliner with about 60 passengers on board, I think it was a Boeing 737, came very, very close to a collision with a UFO. Now, our civil aviation authority took no view on what the UFO was, but be that as it may, there was a near collision. So whatever you think UFOs are, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, that's got to be something of concern. That's the sort of issue that I was trying to get debated.
Yeah. Now, I know you were in Washington, D.C. this past September for the X Conference 3. What are your thoughts on the exopolitics movement that sort of sprung about in the last, you know, since around year 2000 or so?
I don't know. It's difficult. I was invited to speak, so I went to speak, and obviously I was discussing very, very factual issues, pilot sightings, radar visual sightings. Everything that I said could be backed up by material that had been released on the government's website and things. Exopolitics, I think, is rather more difficult to back up. I mean, there are some extraordinary stories doing the rounds, which are not perhaps verifiable in the sense that that the information that I'm coming out is. I mean, clearly all these people are very, very well-intentioned and enthusiastic, but quite where exopolitics fits in with what I would call the more mainstream ufology, where people are very much looking at radar tapes and sightings from police officers and military personnel and analyzing photographs and videos in a scientific way. I don't know. These are two slightly different approaches. I'm not saying that it's the wrong way to do things. It's just a different way of doing things. It's not necessarily the way that I do things, but it is. I suppose a few years ago, we hadn't even heard of the word exopolitics. It's an interesting time for ufology. Exopolitics is clearly a part of it, and it will be interesting to see how it pans out over the next few years.
One of the other things that you've recently kind of got involved in is the 9/11 movement. You're in debates and such. You're on the, you know, you're sort of defending the U.S. side in the 9/11 story, that kind of thing, and you're taking the reverse side, I guess you could say, of the 9/11 truth movement perspective. How did you get interested in this whole branch of, you know, the esoteric? It's kind of a completely off the beaten path of the UFO world. How did you get involved with this, and how did you sort of, like, become a part of the other side of that debate?
Well, I think that because in the UFO community there are a lot of conspiracy theorists, and a lot of conspiracy theorists are interested not just in one conspiracy theory, but in a number of different ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I of course got to hear about these various claims, and people said to me, "Well, why don't you look at 9/11?" So I thought, "Well, okay, I've been challenged to look at that. I'll do so." So as I always try to do in these situations, I looked at both sides of the argument. I attended a number of talks by people who thought that 9/11 was an inside job. I watched the video Loose Change. I went on to various 9/11 truth forums and things to see what was going on. But I also read the 9/11 Commission report. I read the Popular Mechanics investigation into that. And I applied the knowledge and experience that I'd picked up in 21 years working for government, most recently in a security job. And I concluded that actually, you know, this was, as the government said, an attack by al-Qaeda. And frankly, it didn't strike me as surprising that a commercial airliner hits a building, that building should catch on fire and fall down. Now, I've made myself hugely unpopular with a vast number of people. You wouldn't believe the names that I've been called and the hate mail that I've got about this. But I was challenged to take a look, and I took a look, and I'm continuing to look into this. But to me, al-Qaeda had a track record of attacking Western targets. Osama bin Laden had declared a fatwa against the West and had made no differentiation between military and civilian targets. And to me, that seemed to be the most logical explanation. So, yeah, I'm interested in the psychology of belief. I'm interested in conspiracy theories. I will take a look at them, but I will call it how I see it. And I'm not in this business to be popular.
Just the last sort of big picture question. Where do you see ufology and the UFO just ufology, really. We kind of know the UFO phenomenon is going. We don't know. But where do you see ufology going in the future? We've talked about the FOIA revolution in the UK. Here in the U.S., you know, it seems like we've gotten some more mainstream press than we used to in the last year or so. And as we talked about, the exopolitics is sort of getting into this activism aspect of things. Where do you see ufology going in the future?
I think there are a number of strands. Firstly, as you've said, FOI is going to be increasingly important. The French government have released their archives. The British government has made a good start, and there's more to come. The Italian government has released a lot of material. The Brazilian government has released a lot of material. So I think that process will continue. That's part of it. I think the other part, and again, you've alluded to this, some fairly big names have cropped up in association with this subject. Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian defense minister, is somebody who's spoken out about the UFO phenomenon. Fife Symington is again, somebody who's made some interesting statements on this. So I think we're going to see perhaps increasingly some establishment figures speak out. Ultimately, however, I go back to a point that I made earlier in our conversation. This is actually an event-led phenomenon. You can go for months and months without anything interesting happening, and then suddenly you'll have something like the Chicago O'Hare UFO sightings, or the Rendlesham Forest incident, or the Cosford incident, or indeed another Roswell, who knows. So ultimately, researchers can dig and writers can write, but ultimately we are dependent on the sightings themselves and the incidents, and you never know. And this is what, to me, makes this subject interesting. You never know what tomorrow will bring. Tomorrow could bring a case as big as Roswell. We simply don't know.
Exactly, yeah. What does tomorrow bring for you, Nick Pope? What's coming up on the horizon for you? What can people look forward to, from you? Speaking engagements, books, anything like that you want to plug or mention here?
Well, I'm just keeping on, really. Just doing quite a lot of television and radio work, quite a lot of writing for national newspapers. I will continue to research and investigate this phenomenon. I will continue to try and champion it where I can and say, look, we may not agree on everything, but what I do agree, I think, with most people in this subject on is that it should be looked at properly, scientifically, thoroughly. It's very interesting. We've all got different views, but let's try and come together and investigated, and let's try and build some bridges with the scientific community. That's something I'm passionate about. Let's not demonize SETI. Let's not demonize government and the military either, but let's try and reach out to the SETI community, the radio astronomers.
Just to sort of throw in a little side question here based on what you're saying, I get the impression, but maybe it's because I'm sort of like stuck in the UFO community because of the work and the interviews I do and stuff like that, but it seems like the SETI people don't want anything to do with the UFO people as much as the UFO people don't want anything to do with the SETI people.
Well, I don't know. I a couple of months ago, was on a BBC interview where I was debating the subject, and I was and what was interesting was that Seth Shostak and I seemed to agree on far more than on which we disagreed. And actually, I think you know, like many things in life, if you sit down and talk to people, you actually find out you have far more in common than you have setting you apart. So I think that's what I would urge, dialogue. I mean, it has to be a two-way process, of course, but I think, actually, if the SETI community and the UFO community took that little bit of time to just sit down and get beyond the sound bites, they'd realize they were actually after the same thing, but just doing it in different ways.
All right, well, it's important to keep that in mind. Well, Nick, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Like I said, you've easily been one of the most requested guests we've had in the 2 years plus that we've been doing the show. A lot of people write to me saying, you know, when are you going to get Nick Pope on the show? You got to interview Nick Pope. Now, everybody, we've had Nick Pope on. It was an awesome interview. Hopefully we covered some ground that hasn't been done in any of your many media appearances, and I had a great time talking to you. The ufology world needs more people like you. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. The books are Open Skies, Closed Minds, The Uninvited, Operation Thunderchild, and Operation Thunderstrike. And you can find out more information on Nick at the website nickpope.net. Nick, thanks again for coming on the show.
Sure thing. No, it's been very interesting. I've enjoyed our chat.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio. Big, big thanks to the venerable Nick Pope for coming on the show. Of course, you can find out more information on Nick Pope at the following website, www.nickpope.net, nickpope.net. Definitely check it out. Lots of great information there. Moving right along, even though we're running up against the clock, I can't deny the listeners any longer. It's time for BOA Audio listener feedback. This week's letter comes from Jeff in Astoria, New York. Here's what Jeff has to say. Hey, Tim. I wanted to take a minute to write in addition to posting in the forums, after hearing the Keith Chester interviews. Nice job. I can't believe you're the only person who has contacted him for interviews, but kudos to you for doing so. It sounds like it is a very important book for ufology, and it's a shame that not even his local media has taken an interest in his work. I plan on ordering the book soon. Keep up the good work, Jeff, in Astoria, New York. Thank you very much for writing in, Jeff. Thank you for the kudos on the Keith Chester interviews. Definitely one of my favorite interviews for the season so far. Just a wealth of new information there. And there's a tremendous buzz in the UFO community over the Keith Chester book. I should point out also that following Keith's appearance on BOA Audio, the local media in his area did pick up the story. The Baltimore Sun had a nice write-up on Strange Company military encounters with UFOs in World War II. You can either go to the Baltimore Sun or do a Google search. Title of the article was Bel Air Man Writes of UFOs in Wartime. That's a great article on Keith Chester from the Baltimore Sun. So it looks like some of the mainstream media may be taking an interest in Keith's book. Thank you for writing in, Jeff. Again, thanks for the kudos. Stay tuned to BOA Audio. We're going to have a ton of other great interviews coming down the pike in the weeks and months to come here as 2007 turns into 2008. If you would like to be a part of BOA Audio listener feedback, there's two ways to do it. You can do what Jeff did. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, boaaudio@hotmail.com, or simply go to benallofamerica.com, click the contact button on the left-hand side of the screen. It's in the menu. You'll see it. It's not that hard to find. That'll bring you to the contact page, and it'll put you on the road to getting your correspondence to me, and in turn, into the inbox for BOA Audio listener feedback. Up next is, of course, the thanks to the fantastic BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Arlie, Jovi, and Tina Senna. My name may be on the website, my friends, but these people are really the fuel that makes the BOA machine run. This past week, Leslie got a lot of great coverage and press for her piece, Wonderful 40 and Wonders. Chances are, if you're a reader at The Anomalist or some of the other big paranormal news sites, you saw the pickup for Wonderful 40 and Wonders. That was Leslie's Gray Matters at BOA. Leslie, fine job on that piece. Chiron took a look at Coast to Coast AM's occasional weekend host, Raleigh James. A great piece from Chiron, and as usual, looking in areas that have slipped through the cracks so far in Esoterica. As he points out, where's all the buzz for Raleigh James? You're not hearing too much of it, but we're hearing some coverage of Raleigh James via Chiron's K-Files at BOA. And, of course, I would be remiss without pointing out this past Monday, Arlie's Trickster's Realm celebrated 2 years at BOA. I cannot thank Regan Lee enough for her tremendous contributions over the last 2 years at Banal of America. Congratulations, Regan, on 2 years at BOA, and here's to many more. We say it week in, week out, but we say it because it's true, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at banalofamerica.com, you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. If you're a longtime BOA audio listener or an appreciative newcomer and you want to help support the audio series and the website, there's a couple of ways to do it. For starters, we've been talking about it over the last couple of weeks. It's Veiny Mania at the BOA store. We've got about 17, 18 books left, so we're on a pretty good pace here of people picking up stuff from the BOA store and in turn getting a free copy of last week's guest, Jeremy Veiny's book, I Know Why the Aliens Don't Land. Go to banalofamerica.com for details on this amazing deal. Not only are you getting something from the BOA store, but you're also getting a free book, and you're helping the BOA franchise pay the bills here on this audio series and the website. Maybe you don't want any merchandise, maybe you just want to help out, so you can always do that as well. You can go to banalofamerica.com and scroll down past the flashing button for the BOA store, and there's a nice little simple gold PayPal button. Click that, go to PayPal, and make a donation. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping BOA Audio and BOA up and running and freely available for all of our great listeners the world over. Next week on the program, it's going to be December 22nd, and I think you know what that means. It's time, once again, for the BOA Audio Christmas Special. Now, usually, we don't announce the name of the guest until we've taped the interview, but we'll be taping the Christmas special on December 19th, this coming Wednesday. You're just going to have to figure it out for yourself. He'll be making his third appearance on BOA Audio, his third Christmas special, and we'll be discussing his book, Captured, which details the Betty and Barney Hill story. So there's your teasers for you. Should be easy to figure out, but we won't say who it is exactly until I have the interview on tape and ready to roll out for you folks in the great listening audience. There's only one way to celebrate the holiday at BOA, and that's with the BOA Audio Christmas Special. The tradition continues next weekend. On that note, we wrap it up for the week. Thank you, folks, so much for listening. 1,000 apologies for the lateness of this week's episode. Things will settle down, I assure you. It's just been a wild December so far. Come on back next week for the third annual BOA Audio Christmas Special. Until then, this is Tim Banal, signing off.